For example, my chickens go to bed every single night, no matter if it's March or September, at 8:30. Like, it's clockwork. They go into their coop and they get up right at 5:15 every single day. Like, it doesn't matter if it's raining, if it's windy, if it's sunny or not sunny, or if Trump tweeted or didn't tweet.
This is the Entrepology Podcast, the podcast where we optimize the bodies, brains, and lifestyles of entrepreneurs, go-getters, and world-changing innovators.
Welcome to the Entrepology Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Megan Walker. As an anthropologist and naturopathic doctor, I optimize the health and performance of badass women working to change the world as entrepreneurs and go-getters. You know, people kind of like you. Before we jump into the interview, I want to invite you to join our free Facebook community, Legacy. If you want to be something amazing, you need to surround yourself with amazing people. The Legacy community is made up of badass women living, not leaving, but living our legacy every single day. We are leaders, parents, entrepreneurs, and innovators collectively committed to leaving the world better than we found it. My mission is to support the health and optimization of these badass superheroes, literally to places we never thought imaginable. If you are on a mission and get it, that your health is the key to your unlimited potential, then join us. We are super awesome. You can find us on Facebook at www.facebook.com/groups/BE Legacy. See you there. So today was a really interesting topic for me. I sat down with Mike Mutzel. He's the author of The Belly Fat Effect, host of High Intensity Health, a practitioner, and someone who has immersed himself in this field since he was a teenager. We talked about a lot of things, but mostly we dove deep on the concept of the ketogenic diet. And I was excited to talk about this today because this is actually a topic that I wasn't particularly familiar with. I talk about a paleo diet a lot. I'm familiar with the concept of ketosis from a medical perspective, but the ins and outs of actually doing the quote-unquote ketogenic diet wasn't something that I was used to talking about or something that I use particularly often with my patients. But now I might. We went really deep on ketosis. We talked about the microbiome. We got into the health effects of these different components of lifestyle and ways of eating, who should do it, who shouldn't, and whether or not alcohol is actually truly good for your health. It was a really enlightening interview, whether you're the average person just trying to get a handle on your health and some of the high performance opportunities out there, or you're a practitioner wanting to understand a little bit more about the nitty gritty on this particular topic. It was a really fascinating and interesting interview. Without further ado, Mike Mutzel. Mike Mutzel, such a pleasure to have you here. Welcome to the podcast.
Thanks so much for having me. It's an honor to be here.
Well, I'm excited to talk to you about a variety of things. You have experience as a health entrepreneur. You have experience as an author. And you're particularly passionate about the ketogenic diet and some of its applications to both health and just generally a high performance life. Maybe we can just completely back up and you can give us a little bit of the backstory on how you got here. What was your background? How did you find this passion? What's the foundation of your story?
Yeah, that's a really good launching place. Well, you know, it's kind of funny. Some people are naturally and kind of intrinsically motivated and attracted to certain things. And I've always been that way with health. And ever since I remember watching karate movies and Jean-Claude Van Damme and Arnold Schwarzenegger, I just wanted to, you know, have a lean physique. And so I just studied that as a kid. And we're talking going back to when I was 8 and 9 years old, reading bodybuilding magazines. And right when bodybuilding.com first came on, I was always reading the forums there. So I've naturally been interested in it. Got into weightlifting, when I was 13, 14, and then actually hurt my back deadlifting when my second year of college and couldn't work out at all. Then took up competitive bike racing. And that enabled me to really get, high intensity, short duration workouts, similar to what I could get with weightlifting. But over time, I realized that I lost a lot of muscle and got fatigued, and doctors and I got depressed, and all this was anemic and had low hemoglobin hematocrit. And, the doctors at my college, I was on the bike team there racing and stuff like that. They're like, well, we can just put you on an antidepressant. And I thought, well, that's really weird. So I was studying pre-med and I thought, this is their only option. Don't they know about this thing called PubMed that our teachers are telling us to go and look up research at? And there was all these different articles about overtraining syndrome and, adrenal dysfunction and, central nervous system HPA axis dysfunction in athletes. And so I was pulling up these papers because I was, studying biochemistry. And I would bring them to the doctors and say, well, what about this? No, we just take the antidepressant. So I was like, this is so weird. This is a doctor telling me this. So I realized this was like when I was 22, 23 years old, that medicine is like, there's a chasm there, right? Between what's going on in the research and what doctors practice. And so I just got into functional medicine that way actually, and put my resume on Monster. And it turns out that a company called Biotics Research was looking for a salesperson back in 2006 and started working that way. So yeah, I think a lot of us get into this space because of our own challenges with health. And we realize that traditional medicine, while it's great at the acute care, is just not really equipped to help with some of these chronic lifestyle-induced ailments.
Yeah, it's fascinating that you even talk about the concept of an antidepressant, because this has come up for me in practice lately. This has come up frequently in all of, I feel like every conference I've gone to for the last 6 months, antidepressants have been the solution. Yeah. Why is that? Are we all chronically depressed? Like what are we not getting?
Yeah, that's really, I mean, if you look at, what I think it comes down to is the toolbox of a traditional practitioner is very limited. And so you want to give your patient, you want them to be happy when they leave. So what's like an easy thing that will make someone happy? Well, if we just, you know, affect the reuptake of serotonin, that might make someone feel a little bit better, right? So I think that's really what it comes down to, is a lack of tools that we now have access to as integrative natural medicine, functional medicine practitioners. You know, things like looking at neurotransmitter testing, looking at serum amino acids, looking at, you know, B12. I mean, there's a million roads that we can go down and figure out and ascertain and kind of decide the phenotype of someone's malaise and their fatigue. And really, there's a lot of different decision diamonds that we can take. So that's what I think, but I'm not sure. It's just the reaction. But, you know, it's funny that you say that it's this ubiquitous nature, because I was on a hike with some practitioner friends yesterday. And, you know, on the car ride home, it was like three or four people all met at this mountain. We went on a hike, and one of the gals in the car was saying, you know, it's so amazing that so-and-so's wife was out with us, because for years she was bedridden with depression, anxiety, and so forth. And she just got on Paxil and everything changed. And I was thinking in my head, like, well, okay, well, I mean, that may work for a short period for maybe, hopefully that's all she needs and she's good, because she was in a really bad spot. But, you know, that's working on one mechanism of this multifaceted psychoneuroimmunology, endocrinology model, right? So it's really interesting. But, you know, to answer your question, I think it's just the toolbox that practitioners have if they follow that traditional model.
Yeah, and I think there's toolboxes that practitioners have, and then I think there's toolboxes that we all have access to. And I'm sure you've noticed this in the people you've interacted with, and I certainly see it in my patient population, there are certain habits that high-performing, happy people have in common. And please, I'm making the distinction between high performing unhappy and high performing happy, but generally happy people, I feel like, have some commonalities. What is in your personal toolbox that you go to when you're like, it's been a hard day, or I need an outlet?
Yeah. Oh my gosh. It's been exercise. I mean, without exercise, I don't know where I would be right now, you know, in my life. So I think that to me is a huge outlet. Exercise and meditation, and really yoga too. I felt like once I hurt my back, I was forced into doing things I wouldn't normally do, or maybe thought was weird, because yoga back in 2002 was not really as popular. I mean, it was gaining popularity. And so when I hurt my back, I started doing yoga, and that takes me to a whole, I think everyone that's become a meditator, it kind of started with yoga. So I think that, you know, whether it's exercise, nature, yoga, I think those are some of the things. Because yeah, sometimes, you know, we wake up feeling anxious or uncertain, or we're like, you know, feeling like we're not as productive as we could be in a certain day. So you get a little wound up over it, whatever it may be. I think those are natural things to have in your back pocket. And what, instead of turning to alcohol or other substances, I think that's a much more sustainable and a kind of a holistic way to really calm down the body and get more centered. And I mean, even exercise improves heart rate variability and calms down the stress response and does a million benefits. So people that don't embark on, just as a natural prophylactic, you know, endeavor to like go out and do yoga or to meditate, or they don't exercise and they are still happy, it's pretty amazing. It shows like the resilience of the human body, you know, for people who can eat junk food and be sedentary and be exposed to toxins and be on their phone all night and they're still happy. It's like, wow, that's amazing that your body is that resilient and is able to overcome that, you know?
Yeah, I'm at a loss for words when I meet people who are simply that happy. Like, I can only imagine if they exercised. I kind of figured that was going to be your answer. And in fact, I was hoping that would be your answer. And if we take that a step further, and I always talk about this idea of spiraling up, and exercise is one of those things. If we can dial into exercise and we can and go there and use that and know that that's a tool, then there's this opportunity to start to look at diet in a more profound and strategic way. What are you doing right now from a dietary perspective strategically to spiral up?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Gosh, I mean, it sounds so simple and old fashioned, you know. I mean, I do get really deep into the whole ketogenic intermittent fasting, time restricted feeding thing, but oftentimes I find myself wanting to just kind of scale back and look at this from a
mouthful. Just I'm only laughing here. Right, people are like, I'm sorry, what just happened there?
Yeah, just, you know, all the new trends that are coming on with eating, and we realize that, like, if you only eat for a certain period of time per day and then fast for the rest of it, like, you can you know, really enhance some of the longevity pathways in the body. But I think if we just take a scale back and we look at what did humans eat in their natural environment during this period of the year. And so just seasonally eating, I think, is a very just growing my own vegetables. We have over 400 square feet in our backyard dedicated to gardens and have a bunch of fruit trees and a lot of greens and 19 chickens and just like really going back to our roots. And that has really trained me and taught me all these different ideas about protein and macros and when to eat and circadian rhythms. We can dive into all the details. But for example, my chickens go to bed every single night, no matter if it's March or September, at 8:30. Like, it's clockwork. They go into their coop and they get up right at 5:15 every single day. Like, it doesn't matter if it's raining, if it's windy, if it's sunny or not sunny, or if Trump tweeted or didn't tweet. Like, they are in their coop at that time. And it makes me just realize, like, wow, that is so, this whole circadian rhythm biology is so important. Like, you know, here, us as entrepreneurs or business owners or practitioners, like, we let other things get in the way of our sleep and recovery and optimizing our biological rhythms. And we'll try and say we'll make up for it with a nap, or we'll make up for that lost sleep over the weekend. But what if it's just that consistency that's key, right? Like, so that's been really, really interesting and has opened up my eyes, and seeing how much energy and time and work it takes to raise a chicken to the point where it's like actually edible, like there's enough meat on there. You realize, like, it takes so long to get a chicken to that point. Like, most humans, like, if we had no access to other food, we would probably just keep that chicken alive just for the eggs, right? And not eat as much protein from the chicken, right? So it's made me really reevaluate how much protein I'm eating, because I used to be this person, like, 4 to 6 ounces of protein 3 to 4 times a day, a protein shake in between, you know, all that. And it's like, well, is that really sustainable? Obviously you can have a good physique, you know, doing things that way, but what if there's another way that's a little bit more easier on the environment and sustainable? And so we've been eating a lot more eggs and less animal meats, and I don't know, a lot of things like that, and just trying to be very seasonal. Like, for example, we love dill in our salads, and dill is not in season right now, so we're like, all right, well, what else could we put in there? Could we put in tarragon, oregano? Can we use other herbs that are seasonally available right now? And so it's really changed the landscape. And so I think that is a really important, and again, this is maybe a little bit deeper for some people. If they, you know, if you just count your macros and eat low carb and exercise, you're probably going to be okay, you know, for vast majority of people. But I think the next level conversation and awareness is trying to really eat seasonally within your environment. And I think that's where this whole thing needs to go. Because if we look at, like, how we're trashing the environment, the state of the, you know, the whales and the fish, the oceans, I mean, everything is a total disaster. So I think if we can kind of shift the conversation that way, I think that's leveling up or spiraling up, as you were saying, in a totally different way, by not only enhancing your own health, but the health of your community and then the globe at large.
Yeah, I think actually seasonal eating is an easy step. I think it's foreign to people, but when you break it down for them, you're like, listen, like, look around you and eat things that are in season or easily accessible. I think people actually intuitively understand that more than they understand a bulletproof diet or a ketogenic diet or an intermittent fasting type scenario. I think those feel contrived, but I've actually found for my patients, they get it. When I say seasonal, they're like, oh, all right, yeah. I can do that.
You're right, and it takes the guesswork out of it. And then you're like, then people will say, well, should I be in ketosis? And it's like, well, if we look at that, and I've talked to a lot of different people and interviewed, I'm working on a documentary about this. So I've interviewed a lot of scientists, a lot of quote unquote authority figures in this space. If we look at, you know, ancestral humans, a ketogenic style diet and really a high fat style diet was probably more applicable during the winter when some of the starchy foods and fruits and things were not available. So could it be that we can be seasonally ketogenic and seasonally high carb, yet still maintain a reasonable physique and blood sugar regulation? So I think, and as we're recording this now, kind of late summer-ish, I think worrying about your carbohydrates, particularly if they are seasonally available carbohydrates, not, you know, mangoes flown in from South America, right? If there's local berries, local things in your area, should you avoid those to quote unquote stay in ketosis? My answer, unless you have brain cancer, breast cancer, diabetes, Alzheimer's, or you've had a lot of head trauma, and we can talk about why the ketogenic diet would affect those conditions favorably, I think it makes sense to just eat what's in your environment in moderation and focus on the phytonutrient rich fruits and vegetables, herbs and botanicals, focus on fiber and of course healthy fats and lean protein, things like that. But that seasonal approach, you know, and it's funny that you mentioned like your clients and people that you work with. I think definitely in Canada and outside of the US, people are a little bit more fond of that idea. But I feel like, you know, because I live in Seattle and are exposed to, you know, Amazon, there's Amazon Prime. Like right now, if I wanted to order a bottle of pizza, I could have it at my door in like 20 minutes, right? Or something from Amazon Prime, anything. It's like on demand. So we're in this on demand, which is, it's from a business. We're in this on-demand economy and society, which makes sense from a business standpoint and so forth. I mean, entrepreneurs are giving people what they want, which is fine, but is that necessarily healthy? And probably not.
Yeah, well, listen, the first thing I have to say is I'm really glad that local for me includes the Niagara wine region. So I'm completely eating seasonally and locally at the same time. But let's talk about, we talked a little bit and it sort of introduced the concept of a ketogenic diet. And I think people are probably still listening being, you know, on the edge of their seat. What is this ketogenic diet you guys keep talking about? What is it? Let's break it down for people.
Yeah, real simply. It's just a very low carbohydrate, low insulin diet. And so the physiology is such that when you restrict your carbohydrate intake, okay, and that will send signals to the rest of the body, and then you're not going to have insulin released. And those are basically the two physiologic requirements for your liver to then make ketones. Okay. And the main ketone that's floating around the body is called beta hydroxybutyrate. And it's really, I mean, if you go back, I mean, I know a lot of practitioners tune into this podcast and so forth. So if we think about our mitochondria, which I'm sure you've talked about, a cell within a cell, it's where we make our cellular energy called ATP and so forth. A lot of glucose and even protein that's fermented and whatnot comes in as a final common substrate known as acetyl-CoA. And that feeds into the mitochondria to then be converted into a myriad of molecules and secondary molecules, NADH and so forth, but mostly ATP, adenosine triphosphate. When we move our muscles, when we dance, when we laugh, when we think, we're utilizing ATP to fire or finance that movement. Well, it turns out that this molecule, beta hydroxybutyrate, is really just two molecules of acetyl-CoA. Again, the protein makes acetyl-CoA, or it can. So does glucose. It's just two molecules joined together. So it's really just like the storage, the long-term storage and stable form of acetyl-CoA to float around the body, and it can get into the brain and be utilized as an alternative fuel source instead of glucose within the brain. So when people hear about this thing called the ketogenic diet, oh my gosh, women and people with Hashimoto's and kids, and they shouldn't be on a ketogenic diet. It's like, what, let's take a pause here. This is a normal metabolite that's made by your liver when under three conditions, but under starvation, under low conditions of low blood glucose and low blood insulin. So people will say, well, you know, such and such condition, you name the condition that, you know, whatever, Hashimoto's or women or, like I mentioned, kids shouldn't be on a ketogenic diet. And if what I would say to that, well, if you measure their ketones, a woman with Hashimoto's or someone with multiple sclerosis or whatever, after they've gone 12 hours without a meal, they're going to start probably making ketones. Their blood millimolar of ketones would be maybe 0.9 or 0.8, you know, just depending. Or if they went out and exercised for 2 hours, maybe they did a 2-hour run or a vigorous hike. If you measure their ketones after, they're going to be higher, right? So this is a very, very normal physiologic response. Now, what's so unique and what got me particularly excited about the ketogenic diet, because at first when I heard about it, I thought, you know, this is just another fad. And I was writing this book called The Belly Fat Effect, all about the microbiome. And if you read you know, and I was interviewing a lot of the researchers in the space of the microbiome, and what they've actually shown in a lot of their research is high fat diets actually lead to absorption of bacterial inflammagens known as endotoxin, like lipopolysaccharide and endotoxin and so forth. So I was not necessarily a fan of particularly high fat diets for that reason, because it can cause more harm than good in different people, right? So anyway, long story short, but then when I started reading about some of the secondary signaling effects of the ketones, particularly beta hydroxybutyrate, so meaning that when your liver makes this molecule, it's not just making substrates for energy, it's having secondary effects within the immune system, within the brain, and epigenetically affecting DNA stability and DNA structure and even gene signaling. So that is what is so, so exciting. So if, you know, a lot of people say, you know, I have bad genes, or, you know, I wasn't breastfed. My mom, you know, we ate a lot of junk food growing up as kids, or whatever it is, or they had a rough, you know, go at life, a lot of stress, trauma, abuse, whatever it may be. You know, this is one, the ketogenic diet is one way that we can like induce some plasticity within our epigenome, but changing the way that our genes are expressed and the structure of our genetic materials. So when I read about all that research, I was very, very fascinated and discovered that I realized that I just want to know more about this. And I've interviewed quite a few people. And like I said, working on a short film on the topic to really help people understand what the ketogenic diet is and what it isn't. A lot of people think, oh, the ketogenic diet means you're having bacon 3 to 4 times a day. You're having pork chops, fried pork, like French fries. Like that is a very unhealthy way to induce nutritional ketosis. We can talk about, you know, in my estimation, a really good way is in seasonally available fruits, you know, vegetables, a lot of vegetable-based fats, not canola oil, not safflower oil, not cottonseed oil, things like avocado, soaked and sprouted nuts and seeds, coconut. Those are really, really great products. Pumpkin seeds, I just love them. Eggs, and then grass-fed, you know, meats can be utilized there, but it's not, you know, I do a lot of online coaching and have group classes and stuff. And a lot of people have told me like, well, I would go keto, but I don't like pork. And so I'm thinking that again, pork is a prerequisite to ketosis, which is totally not. So hopefully I helped answer, or at least kind of set the stage for a little bit more discussion about keto.
Yeah, I've got a million questions. And awesome. I realized as you were describing this, how visual my brain is, because my brain pictured me on this island right now of a somewhat paleo diet. I probably move in and out of ketosis. And then the great frontier of the ketogenic diet. And lying between it is this ocean of hanger and blood sugar management.
Right.
So, and this is something that's fairly stable for me, but I know for my patients, this is a considerable issue, more so with women than men. How do we jump from where we are now to the great frontier of the ketogenic lifestyle without managing crazy highs and lows with respect to blood sugar?
Yeah, this is a really great point. You know, so I think utilizing dietary supplements can be key. Things like berberine, taking fish oil, some of those compounds can be like shortcuts to help induce ketosis faster, but and also exercise too, like how we introduce this podcast with things like yoga, meditation, exercise. So, you know, when it comes to keto adapting, so to speak, or burning fat more for fuel, being able to go for a longer period of time without eating food and feeling okay about it. So I have a lot of clients who they literally can't imagine going more than 2 hours without food. And so I've been, you know, with clients and they're like, oh my gosh, like, you know, I'm having a blood sugar crash, or I'm getting anxious or hangry, whatever. The nice thing when you get fat adapted is you don't think about food like you used to think about it, right? In the sense that like every 2 hours, you know, I mean, for years, I packed my lunch, my snacks, my backpack, you know, because I had to eat every 2 hours. I had to have protein, I had to have hard boiled eggs, you name it. And it was a very, you kind of felt like you had a, you know, you're on like house arrest with food kind of thing. You know, I've never been on house arrest, but you know, you're like, you're just chained down by food. And so this, what's really nice is like, you know, if you go out with your family for the day and take your kids to go explore and do stuff, go check out a farm or go on an island, whatever, or wine tasting with your friends, you mentioned wineries. The nice thing about when you're keto is you can have breakfast and you can be totally fine until dinner that, and we're not talking about inducing anorexia or an eating disorder. We're talking about feeling satiated for a very long period of time. So how does one go about this? Well, I think the key here, and this is where working with a practitioner and looking at biomarkers like liver function tests and liver enzymes. So some people are just not quite ready to go full keto because they've been insulin resistant for a number of years. They've been overweight for a number of years, and just expecting that to be reversed or ameliorated through a couple of days of MCT oils and, you know, intermittent fasting is not reasonable. So I like to, if people's
Thank you
liver,
for pointing that out.
Yeah. You know, this duration that, because there's so many things on the internet, right, that we hear about. But I think we, and I learned this from Jason Fung, who's actually just outside of Toronto. Great. He's written a bunch of great books. But this idea that if we've been insulin resistant and carrying a lot of excess weight for a while, we need to factor in that element of time into the therapy, right? So, you know, how long you've been either sick or healthy is a factor as to, you know, how intense the therapy needs to be, right? So anyway, what I would suggest is if your liver enzymes are over 30 units, like GGT and ALT, those are very specific for, you know, basically fatty acid infiltration into the liver as a proxy of insulin resistance and dyslipidemia. If your triglycerides are over 150, you know, your hemoglobin and hematocrit are elevated, you're, you know, having, you know, just markers of metabolic syndrome and insulin resistance, then it's probably better to start out with just low carb, high protein, moderate fat, and, you know, kind of slowly transition into the low carb, high fat, moderate protein. So, you know, that protein is very, very satiating and can be easier to digest. If someone has liver gallbladder issues or motility issues and they start eating 200 grams of fat per day, they can be constipated or, you know, have malabsorption, etc. So, yeah, I think, like you mentioned, for blood sugar is a major issue for someone and it's been an issue for a long time, just start out with high protein, low carb, moderate fat. And so what would that look like? That could be like 3 eggs in the morning, half of an avocado, right? That could be, you know, maybe like making a sandwich without bread, some turkey slices with avocado in the middle, and maybe a salad on the side. You know, just more focusing more on lower carb, you know, the moderate to high protein, and then over time can do the whole keto thing with intermittent fasting. But if someone is pretty resilient and they exercise and they do yoga and they walk a lot and, you know, they just want to try it, I would suggest just starting out to like skipping dinner, you know, is an easy way to do that and to induce nutritional ketosis and see how you feel. Are you crashing, you're getting dizzy, you're getting hangry, whatever. And then adding in things like the berberine, the MCT oil. You don't have to use MCT oil. It's just very ketogenic. Exercise is equally as ketogenic. You know, things like that. So I think that is, I mean, there's a million different ways to do this. Obviously, you know, tracking and you can get the Precision Extra blood ketone meter is another easy way to see, are you in ketosis or not? And again, this is all individual. And also for women that are still menstruating, there are some changes, you know, around menses. Forget about ketosis. I've heard from so many people, just don't even worry about it. Just you crave carbs, you're more insulin resistant at that time anyway, just forget about it. And then, you know, mid-cycle, you know, kick it back up again. So yeah, that's what I got. What questions come up?
Yeah. So the thing I keep hearing over and over again is this is just way harder for women. Women don't see the results men do when they're working through a ketogenic diet or lifestyle. Has that been your experience?
Yeah, it really depends on the constitution hormonally. So it turns out that androgens are very ketogenic. And so there's actually been some papers published online with steroid users and using steroid-like compounds, androgens, to induce nutritional ketosis. So that's something that a lot of people don't talk about, but there's a lot of research out there. So it could be an element of the hormonal milieu. Some women tend to be, you know, less estrogen dominant, you know, more androgenic and can put on muscle really well and have really high testosterone and DHEA and things like that. So in that phenotype of a female, ketosis probably and intermittent fasting would not be a big deal. But someone who's very estrogenic and estrogen dominant and, you know, kind of low testosterone, low DHEA, then it might be a little bit more challenging. So it's beyond then just the insulin sensitivity and so forth. So I do hear that from a fair amount of people. And I mean, then if we back up and go, well, why is, I think the biggest question here, and hopefully we can answer this and everyone listening will come away with their own answer for this, but why do you want to be on a ketogenic diet anyway? You know, is it just because you heard about it on a podcast or it's because your friend at CrossFit is doing it? Like, that's not, in my opinion, because this requires a lot of tinkering and testing, a lot of commitment. It can affect your social life because you really need, part of a ketogenic diet is time-restricted feeding. Like, that is a kind of a prerequisite, right? We can't just shift our macronutrients around and eat 3-7 whatever meals a day, and just because they're low carb, high fat, assume that we're going to be ketogenic, because the more, every time we eat, you know, we're spiking insulin and things like that. And insulin suppresses your liver's ability to make the ketones. So this is a huge lifestyle commitment. So unless you've had a lot of brain trauma, you know, a brain cancer, breast cancer, diabetes, Alzheimer's, you know, mild cognitive impairment, or you're involved in an exercise or occupation at a high risk for brain trauma, because the ketones are very protective against, you know, mild cognitive impairment and brain issues. Then if you don't have any of those conditions and you're relatively healthy, you're like, well, then maybe I should just go high protein, low carb, moderate fat, and not try to do this ketogenic thing, because it takes a lot of tinkering and testing, and it can get in the way of your life and your family and your socialization. And I think that's another element of health. So if you disrupt that, you might cause other issues. So that's what I would suggest to people, is really take a scale back and say, okay, why do you want to do this?
So if you're one of my patients who sits in my offices and says, I can't go gluten-free because I get too embarrassed asking the waiter for a gluten-free menu, this is not the intervention for you.
It's not.
And I also wanted to say, because I think there's probably some people who are sitting there going, oh, how do I know if I'm one of these androgenic or estrogenic women? I would venture to say most women veer towards being estrogen dominant versus having a more androgen-based condition. So people who maybe have polycystic ovarian syndrome or some of these types of conditions tend to veer more androgenic, but not always. But there's so many environmental influences that push most women to an estrogen dominant type picture. And maybe I'll also just say, this isn't the kind of thing the average person at home is supposed to figure out, right? Like, we're working with practitioners to get to this place.
Totally agree. Yeah. And I think most women would know too. Like, if they're the type that can really put on a lot of muscle and kind of have traps and like really strong legs, and it can, you know, if they do squats, their legs, you know, they can barely fit in their pants, that's the type that actually may really benefit from the ketogenic diet. And so there's, you know, I think people know generally like where they fit on that spectrum and things like that. So I think that's where, but that being said, you know, I think there's some benefit to, you know, tinkering and testing a little bit. But if you want to try it with your lifestyle and time-restricted feeding instead of like totally changing your diet. So you can, a lot of people can eat a lot of the same foods and healthy, grain-free, low-carb, you know, real food that majority of people are should be eating anyway, and just throw in that element of exercise and time-restricted feeding. So instead of, you know, having a protein shake right when you wake up at 7 a.m. and finishing dinner at 9 p.m., why don't you just compress that feeding window down a little bit? So you're fasting for at least 12 hours, hopefully 15 hours per day. And that's a really what I call like a poor man's way to induce nutritional ketosis without having to totally revamp your diet and introduce all these new foods and learn this new way of eating. So you just, again, just try to fast for at least 12 hours per day.
Where does alcohol fit into a ketogenic lifestyle? Does that happen on the weekend when you're totally not in ketosis, or is it an absolute no-no? What's your story on that?
Yeah, you know, it depends on the alcohol. And so this is another very interesting aspect of it too. So you can have the same quantity of a given macronutrient, like for protein, for example. But, you know, eggs have different amino acids in there that can be, you know, ketogenic or not ketogenic compared to beef, right? So I found that even, you know, wine versus cider versus beer versus whiskey changes, you know, my ketone level. So, and it's different for every single person, and even the type of wine and how processed it is or how much glyphosate or sulfates are in there. So it's really unique. So I think alcohol in moderation, for sure. I know we're in summer right now, and you know, there's barbecues and people want to hang out, and that's really, really awesome. But just be honest with yourself with the alcohol. Are your clothes harder to put on after, you know, the day after? Or do you feel, I think that's the best gauge if things are working or they're not. Like, if you feel lean, you feel tight when you wake up, then alcohol is probably not a problem for you. But if you're feeling lethargic and your head hurts and all that, then probably is not going to work. But interestingly, there's some papers out there showing that alcohol is actually mildly ketogenic, and mildly meaning like small amounts in moderation, social drinking, not binge drinking. So
just to be clear, everyone.
Yeah.
Mildly.
Yeah. So it's, the research is there. So I've personally found that like we, when we drink wine, it's organic local wine and stuff like that. It doesn't seem to have a disfavorable effect on the first morning ketones or before I go to bed, you know, and it doesn't really change things either way. But like I mentioned, cider and other drinks like that, that have a lot of sugar, tend to have a negative effect on that and will drop your ketones, which makes sense because they're spiking insulin. Insulin suppresses your liver's ability to make ketones, so it kicks you out of fat burning.
Well, on behalf of all of us, Mike, thank you for testing these things on yourself so that we don't have to go through the pain.
Right.
You mentioned something earlier, talking about a ketogenic lifestyle and the microbiome and some of the research and some of the experts who have talked about this. Is there a diet that you have found in your experience most restorative of a microbiome, perhaps in the absence of just eating a ton of fermented foods, but is there a way of eating that is most protective in your experience?
Yeah. So I think, you know, the simplest thing, I mean, you can go down a million different roads here, but one researcher, Liping Zhao, he's in China, Shanghai. He's done a lot of research. Actually, one of the few microbiome researchers that it's actually using humans as subjects, because as you know, a lot of the microbiome studies that have come out recently, even Derek McFabe at University of Western outside of London, you know, a lot of great scientists out there are looking at animal model studies. So long story short, Liping Zhao, he's done a lot of human clinical studies and using obese individuals, putting them on a very high fiber, high phytonutrient diet. It's actually relatively high in carbohydrates. It's not ketogenic at all. But mind you, these are in Chinese, you know, native individuals, and has shown a dramatic shift in, you know, endotoxin containing bacteria, proteobacteria. These are gram-negative bacteria that harbor pro-inflammatory particles that, if absorbed, i.e. like with things like maybe potentially bulletproof coffee or a lot of bacon, a lot of fat, can really ignite inflammatory switches in our body and cause insulin resistance. And so he's shown that this high fiber diet and supplementing with native berberine from in different traditional Chinese herbs can, you know, improve bacterial diversity, decrease these gram-negative bad bacteria, if you will, and increase, you know, favorable species like Akkermansia mucinophilia. This bacteria really loves mucus and stuff like that, and helps with the gut lining. And so that's, and also I've talked to Jeff Leach. He's the founder of the Human Food Project, and he actually has studied a lot of, if we think about like paleo people, ancestral people, people that are not industrialized. He's lived with them in Tanzania and parts of Russia and things like that. And interestingly, he finds, and has through his work, he's written a few books, The Wild Diet, and there's a few others. Jeff Leach is his name. But long story short, he's found that just diversity of vegetable matter. So it kind of is confirming what Liping Zhao in China has found, is that a diet of just diverse vegetables. This includes different herbs, botanicals, phytonutrients, spices, tubers, root veggies, etc., really enhances the diversity of the microbiome. So that's one of the things that I underscore. Whether you're keto, low carb, high protein, it doesn't matter what your diet is, just make sure it's diverse. A lot of people get stuck in this thing where they eat broccoli and chicken every day, and then they have a protein shake, or, you know, they eat the same foods. And so one thing that I recommend to all my clients is like, just, I know it's scary, but when you go to the farmer's market, just buy something that you don't even know what it is and just look it up. And that's part of the fun, is how do you cook kohlrabi, or what do you do with celeriac or celery root? Like, that's kind of unique. It looks like a brain. Like, are there different ways to cook it? And so that's part of the fun too. And that helps to get your family involved too. So a lot of people say, well, you know, my spouse is not on board, or my kids don't want to eat this way. Well, if you get them involved, you go to the farm, or they pick it out at the farmer's market, and you kind of have a conversation, you talk about it, you have them rinse it, or better yet, you grow it in your own backyard, then you're helping, you know, your whole family get healthy. And so I think that's, you know, kind of what's really unique. And then you're increasing diversity too. So you'll find when you grow your own food or buy food from the farmer's market, it looks and tastes slightly different from what we were used to, even from Whole Foods, right? So, you know, it's a lot of, there's a lot of diversity amongst even things like bitter greens or arugula or endive or radicchio. Like, you can get a lot of diversity there. So I think those are the two things, again, to clarify: high fiber, high color, in a diverse array of particularly non-starchy vegetables. And then we can you know, tweak the buttons a little bit with how much fat we're having, how much protein, how much carbs based upon the season or based upon our activity level, or how much fat we need to lose or muscle we need to build.
Yeah. And I love at the end of the day, you're talking about eating real food.
And that's the thing.
Just try them all out. Yeah, I'm interested too. I want to shift a little bit, Mike, because one of the things that you've interviewed and had the opportunity to speak to so many different people through your own podcast and your own work. And we're going to have links to all of that because I think that you have so much to teach people. Who has been the most influential or memorable person that you've had the opportunity to interview?
Gosh, that's a really good question. Well, it would either be who I mentioned. Liping Zhao was really, really amazing because I've been following his research for a while. So it's three people and they're all a tie. Jeff Leach was the most fun. Oh my gosh, guys. I mean, if you want to be entertained, he's this just cowboy from Texas, but he knows his stuff and he's just so inspirational. And he just lives out in the middle of some major ranch out in the middle of nowhere. But he just flies and lives and documents these unindustrialized humans. I mean, and lives there. And one of the things that was so inspirational for me, and it changed the way that I'm thinking, that I think about eating animals and things like that. He said, you know, a group of these humans, the males of the tribe will go out and kill a gazelle or a deer or a zebra or whatever. And they would, you know, right there on the spot, you know, they cut the meat off and, you know, before they brought it back to the tribe, they would open up the intestines and eat the colonic material. So they wouldn't eat the fecal matter, but they would scoop out the crap and then eat the intestines. And so he was like, holy cow, here we are thinking that we're eating the flesh, the meat, the buttocks, you know, the tenderloin, the flank steak, and we're totally missing this bacterial transfer from an herbivore, right? So that was, he was like, he could not believe it. So what he, you know, these men and the hunters of the tribe would literally rip out the intestines, take the crap out, eat it, and then they would go kiss their children, hug their wives. They had all, you know, all the diversity of the microbes from that animal on their hands, and they didn't have Clorox or, you know, bleach to clean their hands. They're like going back and making dinner and helping out. And so he realized, like, wow, we're missing out as industrialized humans. Like, we're not going to go kill our neighborhood deer and eat their colon, right? But we're missing out on this massive bacterial transfer. And so that was like a huge aha moment for me and made me realize, like, you know what? Okay, well, what can we do and as real people, just getting out, walking in the forest, maybe having more organ meats like the liver and the heart and, you know, just different things, the whole animal, not just the tenderloin, the ribeye or whatever, right? So I think that to me was a huge aha moment, and it made me realize that, wow, when we think of the paleo diet, having bacon wrapped dates with goat cheese, like, that's not paleo. That is not paleo. So yeah, it's very interesting when we really think about it.
You had all these people when you said that, it went, oh really? They were like, planning their moderate ketosis induced from their wine and their bacon wrapped olives with blue cheese or whatever they have planned.
Right. Their gluten-free donut and paleo donut, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Mike, how do you define health?
If you are vital at the end of the day and you have energy to be with your family and to, I think, you know, health and vitality, I think, are one in the same. So I think if you don't, you know, you can go to the gym, you can eat clean, you can do all that. But if you're tired and you're not full of love and energy and vitality, then I don't think that's truly health. So I would say that you must be vital. You must have that vigor, that go, that umph, that charisma, you know, to get out and you know, help other people. I would define that as health.
Beautiful. That is by far my favorite question I ever ask people. And it's always
an awesome question.
Yeah, well, and it's so different, and everyone's answer is just such a reflection of their experience. It's really awesome.
This episode is brought to you by the Genetic Summit. I don't know about you, but I want to know everything I can about how to take my life and my health to the next level. Looking at genetic information to be able to address your health at a totally different place is cutting edge, and it's precision medicine at its best. Our friend James Maskell from the Evolution of Medicine has pulled together leading experts from around the world together to present information from August 21st to 28th in the free online Genetic Summit. This is an opportunity to understand what you need to know about getting testing, how to interpret the information, and what changes you realistically need to make in your life on a daily basis to take the way you are living to a whole new place. For more information or to register for the summit, go to meganwalker.com/genetics summit. We'll see you there.
It's also a really nice transition point to the second half of the interview. And I call these KPIs or key performance indicators. So just like we would have them in our business, these key metrics that tell us whether or not we're moving in the direction we want to go. I have five quick questions for you that are just, sure. I think, a reflection of you as a whole person and how you live your healthy life. So the first one is, do you have a consistent morning routine? And if so, can you share?
Yes, I do. And so my morning routine is getting up, getting coffee going. I journal for 5 minutes. And so that includes things I have to do, you know, top items, things I'm grateful for. I draw out four quadrants, areas like kind of like mantras, things that I, you know, want to improve upon. And then once I get the coffee going, I go out in the backyard and let the chickens out and, get their food going and all that sort of stuff, water the vegetables. And while I'm doing that, I have an audiobook going. So it varies from mostly personal development, business, mindset, things like that. I don't consume a lot of health stuff, from a retail standpoint. I read the research, but I don't, read health books. And then after that, I go meditate. Well, when I finish the, water the vegetables and I dunk the hose over my body. So I like to do some cold thermogenesis. I find that really helps me then get into the meditative state. So I meditate, then do a Vipassana or insight-based meditation, which is more mindful, compassion-centered meditation for 20 minutes. And then get my daughter up, and my wife's usually back from her walk at that time. And then we kind of get her food ready. And then depending upon the day or if I'm traveling or whatever, my daughter, get my daughter ready for her school and that sort of thing. But that's what I do. That's like ideal. Obviously when I'm traveling, I can't do a lot of that. So that throws things off, and I do travel a fair amount, but that would be my routine.
I love it. Fiction or nonfiction, what are you reading right now or listening to?
Yeah. So I'm definitely not, I love reading fiction, but I always read nonfiction stuff. So let's see, books I'm reading right now. Decisive actually is a book that I'm reading, a few different ones. Sachin Patel, who I think you've had on your show before, recommended The Go-Giver.
Yep.
And so that's like, I don't know if you've, it's cool. I mean, it's a really quick read. So I was reading that last night, about three quarters of the way through that. And then, but Decisive is really, really good. It's all about decisions, how we make decisions and how we can make better decisions. So if you haven't checked that out, I would highly recommend it.
This is not part of my normal questioning, but on Audible or your audiobooks, do you listen to it on regular speed, 1.5, 2 times? Do you have a speed of preference?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I've tinkered around with that a lot. When I'm driving, I like to listen to it faster. But when I'm like watering or walking, I don't like to listen to it faster because sometimes like I'll hit pause and make notes, the Audible app. And so I find that, yeah, I was like, so for a while I was like, oh, I got to do everything faster. Everything's got to consume more, learn more. And I was like, well, like that, I'm not, I don't know. It's like, I'm not trying to hack my life. I'm like, I'm fine. Like, so I realized that I can get more out of it and really think, because, sometimes they pause and I can think about analogies and link that to other things that are going on in my life. So I in the morning, particularly, I don't listen to it. It's normal speed.
Nice.
So.
What is the one thing you are most consistent with respect to your health?
I would say definitely exercise. There's days where sometimes I don't meditate and I know I'm like, I should, or I'm going to, and then I just don't have time. But exercise, like I haven't missed. I mean, like I work out 4 to 5 days a week every week since like I was like 13 or 14 years old. So that would be something that I'm really, unless I'm like totally injured or something, like my back's totally wrecked from too much gardening and squatting at the same time, then I don't miss out on that.
I love that you have gardening and squatting in the same sentence. It's great.
Well, I know because I do a lot of, like I built all our garden beds and did all this, and then I would still continue with my workout routine, and then I would like hurt my back, and then I realized like, okay, like if I'm carrying wood around and shoveling stuff, like I don't need to squat that day. Like I did enough, So I learned the hard way a couple of years ago. And so now I just take it a little bit more easy if I'm doing a lot of yard work.
What do you do for fun or play?
A lot of hiking. So we love that. And I play the guitar, you know, and stuff like that. But, you know, and travel. You know, we were in Indonesia last year and go to different parts of Canada and Asia and stuff like that periodically. So travel and hiking for sure.
And my last question, entrepreneurism. Are we born this way or do we learn to become entrepreneurs?
Ooh, that's a really good question. You know, I think it's a little bit of both. Because my dad is an entrepreneur and owned his own distributorship and, you know, was kind of a self-made guy. And my mom has a lot of unique things creatively in her life and things. But I think a lot of it, you know, is nurture too, like your environment and things. And I think the brain is so malleable. So even if you don't have an entrepreneurial gene in your body, you can become one through training and mindset and sharing. You know, I think and I've learned this through different books over the years, you know, but if you're an entrepreneur, you're just sharing something that is of value to and helps improve the lives of other people. Like Coke is a bad example of that, but it helps. Like at that time, someone is craving something sweet. That's why they drink a Coke. Now, obviously, there's health ramifications for that, right? But so this podcast is benefiting someone. They're learning, they're getting value, writing books. Like, so as long as you're open and have the drive to improve the health of other people or the health or the life of other people, that you're an entrepreneur, you know, so you can be an artist, you can be a cleaner, anything, but you know, having the confidence to then make that leap to be a business person and be self-employed is a totally different mindset shift and strategy, and it's uncomfortable and et cetera. But I think it's a healthy mix of both nature and nurture.
I love it. What a perfect way to end. Mike Munsell, it was such a pleasure to have you with us here this evening. I feel like we could have done this for hours. You're up to so many things. Where can people find more about what you're up to and what you're doing these days?
Sure. Yeah. Thanks, Megan. This was a lot of fun. So probably the best place, I'm pretty active on YouTube and do weekly YouTube live and a lot of videos. So High Intensity Health on YouTube, on Instagram, I'm Mike Munsell, and then also on Facebook too. It's Mike Munsell MS.
Mike, thanks so much. I really appreciate the time.
My pleasure. Thanks, Megan.
If you enjoyed our conversation and would like to hear more, head on over to Stitcher or iTunes and subscribe to the Entrepology Podcast. We would also really appreciate a quick review. When people have their health, they can change the world. Let us keep you healthy and you go change the world.